to see if the recorder is working properly. It's Thursday, October 16th, 1986, and I'm interviewing Mr. Arthur Ross of Apalachicola, Florida, a retired shrimper in his 80s. I'm Barbara Beecham with the Florida Department of State, the Bureau of Florida Folklife Program. Okay, it seems to be working properly. I'm going to ask you your name, sir.
Arthur, A-R-T-H-U-R, Frank, I sign it A-F, R-O-S-S, Arthur Ross.
And?
Arthur Frank Ross.
When were you born, Mr. Ross?
21st day of December, 1913.
Where?
New Albion, Iowa.
So you're a Westerner.
Well, Daddy brought us down here when he was 5 years old, and I ain't never left. 1919, I've been here on this river since 1919. We moved in Apalachicola in 25. And I started shrimping in 29. About 33, I started being kelping, and I've been kelping ever since. But as far as the shrimp, in the other part of the Gulf, I don't know too much about them, but I do know about our local shrimp.
Mm-hmm. Were there any brothers and sisters that moved with you from Iowa?
Well, there was not moved yet. Yeah, there was two sisters. There was two sisters that were born when we come here, but then there was three more boys and three more girls, two more girls born. There was four boys and four sisters. Four girls and four boys.
Eight in the family. How'd you fit in that?
Ma'am.
Were you the oldest of the eight?
Yes, ma'am.
The oldest of the eight. Did any of your brothers fish?
Well, one did all his life, and the youngest one, he did for 8 or 10 years shrimping, but he's worked in Texas and Tortugas and my oldest brother, he died in May of a year ago. He was crabbing at that time, lived down there. They called him Little Frog.
Did your father fish at all, Mr. Ross, and teach you?
My father, he is a freshwater fisherman, catfish and stuff like that. And
in the Apalachicola River?
Yes, ma'am.
How did he do that? What type of equipment did he use to freshwater fish?
Well, what we call a basket, a flat basket, and also use hooks, you know, trot lines and bush hooks.
Did you help him make this gear and fish with him when you?
Yes, and when I was a kid, until I left home and started working in the bay out here.
What year was that?
Well, we started in 1919, when I was 6 years old, when we come here. Mm-hmm. I started, you know, going with him all the time.
Mm-hmm. So you grew up knowing how to fish in the Apalachicola River, catfishing,
yes,
using slat baskets. And then later, did you move out into the bay or work for shrimpers?
Yes, ma'am. I started going on deckhand on a boat then for in 29, and when I was 16, and then about 33, I reckon it was, I started being captain of a boat.
What type of boats were used when you started shrimping?
They were probably about a 30 to 35 foot boat.
How was it powered?
I'll tell you, but you wouldn't know it. Eight horse clays and 10 horse clays, and then we started using some of them was 20 horse lathes, and there was a dozen different kind of motors, Palmers and lathes and clays and Bridgeports and Strattons and, oh
so,
man, there's a lot of motors.
Well, when your father fished, were outboard motors common in that day when you were
My God. When we started out here, they didn't even have a light on the boat. We used kerosene lanterns.
Well, tell me about some of the times when you went fishing with your father before you had the outboard motors. And your first boat had an outboard motor? Shrimping boat?
Not shrimping, no. We had outboard motor up the river. Well, an inboard motor, a little inboard motor. And Daddy come here in 25, and we oystered at East Point and for about 3 or 4 months, and he didn't like the bay at all. He wanted to go back in the river swamp, you know. And at that time, we had a pair of oars and a pole we went to the bar with. There wasn't no such thing as a motor. Most all of them had to. Then later on, I don't know, they started getting a little motors. And
did he build his first boat that he went to the bay?
He built the river boat, sure did.
And did he build his oyster tongs and his pole?
No. At that time, they had a couple of men here in town that built oyster tongs. And then his boy, that fellow's boy, went after he come back from the service, he went in business and built oyster tongs. His name was Roy Smith.
He's still building oyster tongs?
No, he died too about 3 years ago. His wife died about 6 months ago.
So you've started out fishing before the outboard motor, and you used an oar or either a pole to get into
for freshwater fishing.
But what about going out into the bays when you first moved here and they were not using outboard motors? What were the shrimpers using at that time?
They were all inboard motors.
Inboard motors, but they had motors in 25.
They had motors here in the shrimp boats. They started off with some little 5-horse and 6-horsepower motors, but them motors had a whole lot more power than the motor, 5 or 6 they got now.
I've been told that the shrimpers first started using the oysters and first used the sailboats to go out.
They did. Mm-hmm. They all had sails. I never was on one.
But you remember those?
Heck yeah. Mr. Willie Fred Randolph down here, his boy runs a Standard Oil Company down there. His daddy had a sailboat, and he never did put a motor in it. Called it the Cannonball. Old man Jack Randolph was Willie Fred's daddy. I asked Willie Fred a while back when he was born. He said 19-1, but he's got the way, I don't know, in the last year or two, where I don't know whether he understands when you talk to him or not.
What you're saying.
I know he can't hear, but he was one of the first dealers that I started working for here.
When you were shrimping?
Yes, ma'am.
And you've always shrimped. That's the only type of fish that, besides...
No, I oystered too.
Oh, you oystered.
See, when we started here, we start about April, April, May, and June. And then we stopped July, August, and September. That resupplied your stock. And then we started in October, November, December. And then we oystered January, February, and March. Well, at that time, in December, January, and February, March, there wasn't no shrimp. They had all went outside, and we didn't have big boats.
How big was your boat? Your shrimping boat at that time?
Well, I started off with about a 33-foot one, and after I bought one, and then I wound up with a 60-foot boat, a 57-foot.
You said you started off with a 33 and then bought one. So was this one that a fishing company had that you fished for?
Well, the ones that I first started running boats, that's right, they belonged to the companies. The companies, there was no independent boats then, and it was all company boats. And Then some fella, he had one, and I bought it from him, and I started running my own boat then. I don't know what year that was, about 37 or 38, I reckon, and I owned my own boat ever since.
Did you build your first boat, or had
no,
you built
well,
one?
We had a, well, there'd be boat builders around, and they build them. I couldn't put a board in the side of one and get it straight. Now, I did build all my shrimp trolls, all that. All of that that I've ever had. But after I'd hire you to fix them and you wouldn't do it right, and I learned how to do it myself. But that's the only thing I ever did learn about equipment. Of course, we'd try to fix an old motor and get it back home if we broke down somewhere, but if in town, well, we always got somebody else to fix it. I'm supposed to have been a mechanic, you know.
When you first started fishing in the Apalachicola Bay, how many fishermen do you suppose were using that to make a living? You know, 25?
There was probably 40 or 50 people here shrimped. And I couldn't say about the oystermen. I don't know. There must have been 400 or 500 oystermen.
Have you ever known of any women that oystered?
Women?
Mm-hmm.
Not in them days. They're going out now. They're going on it, but they come back in 5 or 6 hours, see? 6 or 8 hours. No, it wasn't a... It wouldn't have been nice for a woman long in them days, holding around and staying out in that wet and working like them people. Them people worked them days, them old timers.
How long did you stay out when you were oystering?
Daily trips.
Go out in the morning and come
we'd
back?
We'd leave about 4:30 in the morning, where we'd get on the bar by daylight, and then we'd work till about sundown, get back home before dark. Generally, it takes an hour and 45 minutes each way, you know. The boats will make 6 or 8 miles an hour.
And how many fish houses were here when you were shrimping and oystering? I noticed there's a number of them now.
Well, when I started, there was only one at East Point. And there was three in Indian Pass. There was one down where the pass is, and then there was a 9 mile and 11 mile. There was oyster. At 13 mile, there was oyster houses in all three of them places.
But none in Apalachicola?
Ma'am.
None in Apalachicola?
I can't tell you exactly how many there was, but they was all on the dock. There wasn't no such thing as a mile down here to 2 miles. I say there was 12 or 15 oyster houses.
In East Point, Apalachicola?
No, in Apalachicola, right, in Apalachicola. 10 or 12 at the least.
So
must have been about 34 or 35. The boat took half. In other words, they was paying us 2 cents a pound. The boat took half after we paid the expenses. And $20 would pay our fuel and ice and groceries for a trip, 3-day trip. And to take, that is 1,000 pound of shrimp we had to catch. And then on 1,100 pound, you'd make 50 cents and I'd make 50 cents. On 1,200 pound of shrimp, we'd make $1 a piece.
You're talking about the fish house or the crew that you took along with you?
The crew would get fit and make, there was 2 men on the boat. Mm-hmm. They had, at that price, at that time, of course, that was just 1 year. And then things started, after Roosevelt got in office, well, things started picking up. Actually, we couldn't even sell shrimp along in 33.
Really? There was no market for them, or just no fisheries that could ship them?
There wasn't, well, they had ice. They started later on shipping them to the Fulton Fish Market in New York, and the Moffa got a hold of them, and they They were robbing us all the time. I didn't realize it until a little while back, a year or two ago. I read a piece in the Reader Digest about how they were doing in 20s. You bring your truck up there and they wouldn't unload you if you didn't give them 10% or 15% of what was on there, see, and then they paid you what they wanted you to pay anyhow. And then they got the money and they control the buying and the selling.
How much were you getting a pound from the fish houses here when you'd bring your 1,000 pounds of shrimp in?
The lowest I got was 2 cents a pound, $2 a hundred.
And you only had you and one more crew member that was shrimp.
Yes, ma'am.
So you never went 2 or 3 days, but it was always right here in the bay, or did you?
No, we worked outside to Cape St. Blair.
Cape St. Blair.
And that's as far as our white shrimp ever migrates. They don't even go to Caribel. These local shrimp don't here. And what we got here is a native. Now, we have got what we call a brown shrimp and we call a hopper. Now, they come in, but the white shrimp, they grow up here until they get a certain size, about a 26, 30, with the heads on, and then they get eggs in the back, and they go outside and lay them, and then they die.
That's the white shrimp.
Uh-huh. That is the local white shrimp. We did not have a brown shrimp here until I married in 37. And that was the first year that we ever had but a brown shrimp. We called them, they thought they'd come in from Brazil because the water had been so hot that year, And it's possible they did. But there was no such thing as a brown shrimp, a brownie, until 1937. And I don't believe they showed up in Louisiana, Mississippi, and them places until in the 40s.
So the brown shrimp is different from the local white shrimp.
Yes, ma'am.
You've caught all your life.
And then we got another one, too, we call a hopper.
Now what does it look like?
Well, he's a shrimp about the same size. They all brown, white, and hoppers run the same size. Brown and hoppers will get a fraction bigger, a 5 count bigger than the white shrimp. But a hopper, he's got a spot on his side, and he don't live in no mud at all. He don't like no mud at all. And a white shrimp has to have a mouth of a yellow river with mud coming down it. To survive. The brown shrimp, he likes it about 100 degrees, and when it gets cold weather, he's gone. Boy, they go back to deep water.
So shrimp.
They're all three different, but they're all about the same size, and we got different times of year to catch them.
And they all bring different prices?
No, they all shrimp after you get them peeled.
Do they taste differently?
Not unless you catch them in a different place. Now, if you catch them in a different place, they got a different taste. Now, Louisiana shrimp has got them that they used to catch around there, especially a mullet and oyster, they got taste like they got oil in them. In Texas, it's so bad you can't eat them, you know, around. But ours, boy, we got the best taste in seafood. Well, I don't say in the world, but we got the best that I've ever seen in the United States because I ain't been nowhere else.
Well, what do you think makes the seafood around here better than any place in the world?
Mouth is fresh water, this river, and if you don't have that, you close that river up and they all perish. The crabs, the shrimp, and everything would completely be gone.
You mentioned a yellow river. What is a yellow river?
Clay, where it drains out of Georgia and Alabama.
And that's what Apalachicola.
Now, when we leave here, leave Cape St. Blair, you don't find no more white shrimp. Well, you find a few in Pensacola back up there. But there ain't none on the outside beach until you get to Mobile River, which is another yellow river. And then there's yellow water from there on to... Well, I reckon the Rio Grande's a muddy river when it rains, and there's shrimp all the way there, of all three kinds.
Well, You said you never shrimped past Cape San Blas. Did you ever go with other shrimpers on out to Texas, Mississippi?
Oh, yeah, I worked on later on. After the boat got a little bit bigger boat and more power and lights and everything on the boat. Well, now, I worked Tortugas, and I also worked Mississippi. Made one trip to Texas and went out there and stayed a week and didn't catch none. But there was a lot of small ones, but they had a 35 count tail law, and if you caught anyone smaller than that, well, they'd arrest you. So that last night we was out there, they lost three boats and drowned two men, so I turned around and come back to Mississippi where it wouldn't be so darn far from the dock.
Was it a bad storm that came up?
Well, it blows out there. They just happened to come. Wasn't a hurricane or nothing. It just, just bad weather. Just a front or something. And them people took a lot of chances. A lot of them got lost for them people.
How did you predict weather conditions? I mean, how do you know when to take chances and when not to with the weather?
They didn't have no weather reports.
Mm-hmm. When you first started, no way to predict the weather.
Mm-mm. Now, the old timers had barometers. They always bet on the barometer.
What did the barometer show? Did you also use a barometer and swear?
Yes.
What was it showing when you knew it was safe to fish or not safe?
Well, ordinarily, the United States barometer set on 30 millibars. Or not millibars, but whatever it is. It's not millibars. Millibars go something else. But it sets on .30. And if it falls, shut up, D-Bird. If it falls a little farther than that, falls too far, you know there's going to be bad weather. A hurricane, they'll go down to 28 or 27.50 in a bad storm. Which is
before the storm comes, you can watch the barometer.
Oh yeah, you know that something's coming.
So that was one way you had of predicting the weather, is when the barometer started dropping, you started making for shore.
Yes, but most of the time they figure the boat's supposed to bring you back outside of a hurricane. We watched hurricanes, and we watched bad nor'westers, because it used to blow 50, 60 miles an hour out of nor'westers. When I started shrimping, saying before 41, the state or the federal government sent an old doctor here, a scientist, a biologist, and he moved to Indian Pass and stayed down there about 3 or 4 years, named Dr. Idale, out of the University of Miami. And that old man knows more about what went on then than all this modern stuff that they've learned since then. Because I talked to him, and he sat out that night and had put his little traps out there to catch the spat eggs and stuff that come in when the tide had come in, and he'd go run them every 2 or 3 hours or like that. And I don't know, they built a laboratory down there at Indian Pass. Now there's a lot of that stuff put up, that stuff that he put up. I know that that's kept somewhere, but generally when it looks like a biologist or a scientist that's interested in anything, they write anything down and give anything to somebody else, smart bird there in Tallahassee or in the federal government. Hide that because it might interfere with his job or something. Mm-hmm. But that old man knew. He knew exactly what an egg looked like, a shrimp egg, and he knew how long it took to hatch. I read some of his literature. He said it took him 3 months to be a canary size, which is right. And then in 3 weeks, under the right ideal conditions, their weight would go from a 60 to a 30 in 3 or 4 weeks. See? So therefore, if you took care of your little ones, you would have some bigger ones. But now, I'm telling you, that I know that stuff probably ain't burned up or sold away. Somebody might have discarded it. But they wasted all that time. And that old man was out there 1, 2 o'clock at night. If the tide was supposed to come in at 2 o'clock, he was out there. And had a assistant to tell it to, you know. But there's a lot of information been put out on shrimp and seafood and stuff. If they'd go back and look at that instead of trying to figure somebody's been in it 5 years, they'll tell them all what to do, why they'd be better off. You know, if they're trying to build them back, and if they don't take care of what we got, every year it gets worse. Every year it gets worse. Now this year they're not doing anything hardly. And a lot of the boats are tied up, and they're running here and running down there. Don't know what in the world they're going to do. But 3 or 4 weeks ago, there was a few little shrimp showed up down there, and one fella had 3,500 pounds of them one day, 150 count with the heads on. They'd be 300 count tails. They wouldn't be that long, but they caught them anyhow. So how can you expect to have anything when people do it like that? And in petricides, I didn't know what was wrong in 41 and 42. See, there, somewhere along the line, me working like a fool for nothing for these dealers here, they're drafting everybody. So I was in a 4A. I was classed in 4A, a wife and a baby. Well, later on I got wondering, they're calling everybody else, how come you ain't call me? I went and asked the girl down the draft board. She said, well, you look, say you got a 2-year deferment. Some of these big shots here went and got me a deferment because I was shrimping daytime and patched their nets at night during the war to keep food going on, and the draft board man knowed that. He run the old house. And I was doing a lot of good. I was keeping up about 8 or 10 boats of nets, you know. That's the way I paid for my little boat. They would never let you make enough shrimping to pay for a boat. If you caught a big load, they cut the price.
You know how much your first boat cost you?
$700. Well, now it had a little old sold-away car motor in a Chevrolet, 6-cylinder Chevrolet. You ain't cold?
Kinda. You want to let's move in? Okay, we're going to move inside the house now. Okay, now, Mr. Ross, now that we've moved inside your kitchen where it'll be a little warmer and maybe a little quieter, I want to ask you about the gear that was used on the boats, like your nets that you said that you helped make. What were they made out of and how big? Maybe you can describe a trawling net for me when you first started shrimping.
Well, the biggest we had was a 36-foot spread.
Excuse me, Mr. Ross, but I'm going to run out of tape. I should have noticed that before now, but it's blinking telling me, so I'm going to turn it over and ask you that question again. Now let's check and see if it's recording. It is, and I'm going to ask you to describe the nets, or what did you call them if they were not nets?
Shrimp troll. T-R-A-W-L, troll. And the biggest net we had then was about a 36-foot net. And I suppose 5-foot, 20-inch doors, you know, 5-foot long, 20 inches high. You know a shrimp door? Well, you know a kite.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they are bridled say they like that. Don't. You don't have to. They just. You got a chain here and a chain here and a chain here and a chain here. And this bottom chain is set. Well, sometimes one link and sometimes two links to make that door hug the bottom. Its principal job was to spread the net on the bottom. Mm-hmm. And if it got deeper, why, it went right down in the holes and worked up and shallowed up. It'd come up, and that was the gear.
So it was like a door that funneled the shrimp into the net that was in the back of it?
The net, yeah, comes 36 foot here. So here's a pocket. Mm-hmm. And 36 foot here, and the boat's up here, the door's up here. Most of them nets, I imagine, was about 30 foot, and there was, I think our standard stuff was 9-inch, 9-twine cotton. 9-thread twine, mm-hmm. cotton.
And you said you learned to make those.
Well, we learned how to. We bought the webbing, and the webbing's made on a machine. And we bought the webbing and then cut it up and made it like we wanted it. Like you'd cut up a bowl of cloth and make a dress or something, you know. I learned that pattern, and then I improved on it a lot. I reckon that I have caught more local shrimp here than any man alive, or any man that's ever been here. I'm talking about with these small brigs, but now since the government got messing with it and put all that money in them for them big shots, they done the same thing that they, way I read on the, look on the TV and the news, they done the farmers the same way. They loan the money, tell them how much they want it, or the high price interest, and the farmers losing all the farms and everything else, and selling out to the big combine. When later in life, they started loaning these big dealers money to build big boats. Well, that was fine for that offshore shrimp, and what I'm talking about, where they worked Mexico and they went to Campeche and the southern part of the Gulf and all the way around, you know. But that put this out of business. Because them people, instead of keeping the boats, work the boats where they were supposed to, they'll start right back in there on our stuff, and where our little ground, which we ain't got too much ground. Our ground is say from East Pass to Cape St. Blas, that's all they are, from Carabel to Port St. Joe. That's all the ground we got, the local round. But I caught 175,000 pounds one fall in 20 weeks with a 30-foot net and one man I had a 30-horsepower motor then.
Was that the greatest amount of shrimp you've ever caught?
Yes, ma'am.
And how much did you get a pound for it then?
Probably about 3 cents.
And it would vary as the shrimp.
Yeah.
Did you have a large crew with you when you were
one man?
You and one more. Well, that was.
And then later on, I started taking, after we got a lot of. Oh, excuse me. My wife started going with me. I started working by myself for years, all during the war. I worked by myself, and I found out I could do it so much better, and I never did have an argument with the crew about coming down at 4 o'clock in the morning where we get up and go out. And so I just started doing it by myself. We got winches, power on the boat, you know, and lights to something to pick up your rig with. And I worked by myself from then on.
You said your wife went with you.
Well, yeah, but if she didn't, if she was sick or something to do, I went right on it. She didn't hold me up.
What'd she do when she'd go with you, Mr. Ross?
Oh, she worked like a dog. You know what I mean? Same thing a man Well, when you pick them up, when you catch shrimp, they're never clean. They always have to be picked out of the fish and the jelly and the mud and the stinging nettles and trash and wood or whatever you pick up. That troll will get everything on bottom if they don't get too big and tear it up.
So you'd winch it up with your hoist, and what happened to the shrimp then?
We dump them on deck and pick the shrimp out and...
What'd you put them in?
Ma'am?
What did you, when you were picking the shrimp off from the deck, how'd you do that? By hand? Did you wear gloves? Just pick them up?
Gloves just got in the way generally.
Mm-hmm. You picked them up with your bare hands, cold them out, and what did you put them in then?
Well, we had a system, sometimes a bat, and sometimes a tub, and sometimes a bucket, and wash them good, and then we put them down below deck in the ice, iced them. We never kept a second drag on deck. We always, when you got called off, you washed them and you put them below and iced them. And then do the same thing over and over again.
So you didn't believe in the superstition that a woman on board is bad luck.
Mm-mm.
Do you know of any shrimpers that feel that way?
Well, them old timers did, but it was just because they were born that way.
Did other shrimpers take their wives with them?
Yes, there's women captains.
Really?
Yeah.
Any of them still around here? Any of the women captains still around here that shrimped when you shrimped?
No, I don't think so. I never had no to one around here, just an individual that ever was captain there. I run in Pascagoula, Mississippi one day. I tied the side of a boat, and there was a young woman. She was 30, I reckon, then. She was messing around on the boat, and I asked her, I said, "You on that boat?" She said, "Yeah, I was born on it." She was running the boat trying to pogey fish, catch a menhaden. She said she had trouble trying to keep a crew, you know, and I think she'd give that up. She was from off of the Pacific. She was born on a boat, and her mother died, and then her daddy died, and she was 15, 16, 17 years old, I reckon, by then, and she took it over and was running it. She'd burn her face so bad, had holes in her face, so she'd tar. We used to dip nets with what we call coal tar, and out in that hot sun, it'd burn and blister, you know, and she had little holes all in her face, and I asked her one day, the next third time I seen her, how come, what'd she do, get hot grease in her face or something? She said, no, that was out there one day fixing a net and that hot tar got her.
You ever had that happen to you? Have you ever had that happen to you?
Not in my face. I've had it burn my hand mighty bad.
So you dipped your nets in coal tar too?
In them days, yeah, that cotton, and that was cotton webbing. Now they got nylon and rayon and monofilm and all that kind of imitation stuff. I mean, it don't rot. That cotton would rot if you left it 3 days wet while the sun hit it. It'd burn it up.
But that coal tar preserved it?
It'd also burn it up. It kept it some. It kept the slime and stuff out of it. I'm still cold.
Bless your heart. You gonna turn on the oven?
Would you like to pour a coffee?
I would if you're gonna have some.
I don't know whether you like that mess or not.
Okay, now that we've got our coffee and I feel a little warmer, and I hope you do too, I'm going to pin your microphone back on. Let's see, let's turn it up this way. This is so just like you see on TV. Now I'll make a check, and I was interested to find out that your wife worked on the boat with you, and Did you have any, I heard you say you had one daughter. Did I hear you say, or one son? You said the wife and the baby.
Well, this lady I married in 74, my first wife I married in 37, she had a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as me, I have never had a child.
I see. So you're the last of a fishing family around here.
Yes, I never.
How'd you name your boat, Mr. Ross? Did your boat have a name, your shrimp boat?
Well, they was all named when you got them. I had one I named after my first wife. I had it built, 50 foot.
Well, I'm sure you were proud of that boat.
It wasn't what I needed. I got messed up and got in debt to a finance company, and they gave me something that had stuff that wasn't good. The power, the lemon, I'd get 50 miles out in the Gulf there and break down.
Mm-hmm.
I got messed up on that. I had a fine little rig there to start with, but they kept building bigger boats and they working everywhere in the world, so I decided that's what it was the thing to do, you know, but I messed up on it.
So you bought a boat that was already built and named it after your first wife. Was it a new boat?
Then we built that one.
You built that one. Is there any special, anything special when you put a boat in the water around here that shrimpers do for a new boat? When you put your boat in the water the first time?
No.
No.
They don't christen them. I mean, you don't. Well, they name them, but you name them, you got to go through the federal government. It used to be in Pensacola, and you send them off what you got, and they'll put it in a log, and they'll. I'd call it a logbook. I don't know it. The ships, they got a name for that stuff of all the years ever built.
So they probably give it a number with your
you
name.
You also get a, that's what counts. The name don't count. You have to, well, we have a cabin on the front and the engine room on the back in there or something like that, but it's midship. There's what we call a hole where we put ice and everything else that you. And then that deck beam across there where I don't even know what they call that. But anyhow, it's a number. The numbers of. They give you.
Registration number?
Registration number. And that went in the books. It had to be cut a half inch deep. And the main beam that goes across the boat, one of the deck timbers, and you can swap the name, paint a name over it, steal it, you know, and run a name over it. You couldn't get that out
mm-hmm.
unless you was to change that timber, that whole timber.
Mm-hmm. Were you responsible for putting that, carving it, the number in
uh-huh.
there, or was it burned in there? How?
Well, most of us use them. I got somebody to cut it for me. I use a little wood chisel.
Mm-hmm.
And they cut them numbers with a little wood chisel, you know. Cut them letters in. They got to be, I don't know what they were, 3 inches or 4 inch numbers. And that is the way they identify the boat, because a lot of them are stowed, and there's been a lot of them stowed, and they ain't never seen no more of them.
Of all the times that you've shrimped, go ahead and write up. I was going to ask you, Mr. Ross, of all the times that you've shrimped, what time stands out now in your mind of the? And we might have already covered that when you told me about catching this, ever how many tons of fish that you caught. Which stands out in your mind now that you look back on shrimping, or maybe what year stands out in your mind? the best time that you had when you put out to shrimp?
You mean as far as supply, numbers?
Whatever. Maybe it was when you had your wife on there for the first time. Maybe that was a memorable occasion, or maybe it's the greatest amount of shrimp that you caught. Maybe it was being caught in a storm. Which stands out now that you look back?
Well, one night, she just wanted to go. And we had been fouled up with a trash, what we call June grass. You couldn't throw. Fouling it up. And we was outside there one night, and I know what's to come out, freezing, raining. But the grass moved off. And that night, I think we caught around 7,000 or 7,500 pounds with the heads on. And then, anyhow, she said, "I'm going to bed." And I had a boar on there with me, a man, you know. She said, "I'm going to bed. If you make a big strike, well, call me." At that strike, we had 7,800 pounds. And that grass was leaving, and them shrimp were getting thicker. It was December, and we hadn't caught none until December. And the next day we picked up, we had 3,500 pounds in the bag, so we couldn't pick it up at one time. So we had to take a rope and get underneath the bag, which is a long sack, and cut half of it, and I dumped half of it, about 1,700 pounds on deck. And then while I put the rig back on the rest of them to pick it up, I went to the house and got her, called her out, and she run out there, and it was freezing rain. He don't pick that other bag up as he's doing that, I'd go untouched, you know. She started to watch there second in that rain, and ice water hit her. She had business back in that cabin.
So she'd gone below deck to sleep. And she went back.
Yeah, it's warm in there. Mm-hmm. That motor running, you know, and everything going on.
But she did come back and help you.
Not that night.
Not that night.
No, sir, she didn't come out.
What was the worst storm you ever got caught in? Was that? Or what's?
Well, I have never been caught out in a storm, because we always managed to maneuver around. But I reckon the worst thing I ever seen was about 4 or 5 years ago in Frederick, hit Gulf Shores. Mobile Bay. I went over there to this dry dock was tore up, the shipyard, so I ran the boat to Mobile, Alabama, or not Mobile, but Mobile Bay on Gulf Shore down from Foley. And they had a dry dock then. I got on in, I got off that night, and I was getting a weather report then. We had a radio. I knew the storm was coming then. And I went up and tied up and stayed on the boat that night. Now, it blowed, I'm telling you. Of course, it blowed in this storm we had this last year here, both of them. Mm-hmm. I took my wife both times and went up above Marietta and both of them storms. I don't know how these houses stayed. It blowed these oak trees down. There's two pine trees right across there that had been there 1,000, 1,500 years. It blowed them down. We've seen some bad weather, all right.
I'm sure you have. But you've been fortunate not to have been caught in any of it out there on the, when you were shrimping.
Not none. I've got caught in 50-55 mile an hour weather out there. Well, we was trying to get in the best we could. We got snapper fish a lot of times, you know, out of here when there wasn't nothing else to do. And one winter we went out and a nor'wester caught us. I don't know what it was, 50 mile an hour wind, I reckon. But I got so blessed and seasick that if the boat had tore up, I wouldn't have cared. And we'd been out about 10 days and hadn't had nothing, and the 9 didn't have nothing. We stayed 12 days on them boats, 50 foot. And We didn't have no fish, so nobody would give you nothing. We stayed on, we rode out for 3 days. We put up about 12, 13 days, and then we fished about 3 or 4 more days after that. Come in about 16, 17 days after we supposed to have been in 12 or 11. And they know we was gone. Everybody thought the boat was gone, because in 29 they lost one out of here. They had 9 men on, local men. Never heard of them and never seen them since, you know. They lost a lot of them. We've had a hard life.
Do you consider shrimping a dangerous occupation?
Not now.
But when you first started?
Oh, yeah. Well, it wasn't bad then, because we wasn't too far off. 2 or 3 hours we could get back, to 3 or 4 hours back, you know.
And always in sight of land?
Now?
Were you always in sight of land back?
Yeah, long in them days we was, yeah. We was outside in the Gulf, but there'd be a pass so you get back in and go back home. We never worked over 2 or 3 hours away from the house, you know, and by that time watching the barometer and everything, why weather, well, even if you didn't have no barometer, you know it was getting bad. You know, birds know it.
Is that one way of telling? Is that one way that you also told, by watching the birds?
Well, there wasn't no birds out there. They stripped seagulls.
Yeah.
And they didn't pay no attention to it. But you get a feeling when you're born, raised up like that, that you know, you can tell. Or you can tell even when the sun comes up or when the sun goes down. I was sitting up here the other night thinking about, we could have flying saucers all over every night and nobody'd ever see one, because they're in watching TV and the light's in your eye and you can't. I saw a flying saucer one night. In other words, I saw something that there's no way to explain it. We didn't have nothing like that in, you know, military. That thing come out of the southeast, I was laying out there in the anchor, and I laying out. We was working in the daytime then. And it was hot, and I was laying out on deck there, with a pillow under my head, laying on the hatch. And that looked like a shooting star come out of the southeast and going across. And I know if you've been out, you saw a shooting star, how fast they go. And then they'll explode, a shooting star, where they'll go out. Well, this thing got about 1 o'clock in the 1 o'clock, you know, back in the west. And it started getting bigger. I said, oh my God, that thing gonna fall on me. And I saw the star falling, and then it got, I don't know, 5 miles up, 15 miles or 1 mile. But it got big, and it started getting bigger, and then it started. Yeah. And then it started throwing some pulsing rainbow-colored lights out around it. And went right straight that away and disappeared. I mean, it was just when it went, why it went. And next morning I was down on the end of the dock. There was sort of bad weather then. And there was a kid down there about 16, 17 years old. And I said, you know, I saw something funny last night up there. He said, you mean about 10 o'clock? I said, yeah. He said, when that thing come across like that, I don't know. I said, yeah. He said, I seen that too, but I wasn't going to tell nobody.
Did you come back and tell anybody besides that kid?
No. Well, me and him talked about it a while.
Was anybody out with you
on the boat that time? No, I was by myself then. Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the most unusual things you've seen out. Have you ever seen any other unusual things out there?
Not was like that. Most of the things we see, we figure out.
Yeah.
But that.
What are some of the things that you would see and think, now what is that? And later find out what it was.
Well, nothing unusual. As far as animals or anything like that. Now, weren't even going out this cut out here. We were going offshore 12 miles. That was the only I had, that boat I had built. And it's foggy. And the sun was shining all out ahead of it, but there's fog behind it.